Okay, good. We're back on schedule. Excellent stuff. So the next session is about you. You'll be delighted to hear. So this is more to do with how does this apply to me? What does it feel like to do a project like this? And what can I take from what we've just heard and what we're about to hear, and use this in my organization. Now, I know we have a number of different kinds of organizations. We have museums, public libraries, consultants, account managers from other information providers. So forgive me while I generalize for a second. So you'll remember earlier on that we talked about archiving, bringing data to life and all that that means. So what does that mean? So from your point of view, you will have some unique motivations, some unique things that are driving you to worry about your data. And it is about worry, actually, in many ways. So what are the reasons why you're feeling that you need to preserve and archive your data? Is it about protecting these precious assets? These are rhetorical questions because I'm sure the answer is actually yes to everything, as I mentioned. But it's worth thinking about it, I should say, in the context of being able to explain this internally. So from a business case point of view, from an internal report to your directors to say, this is important. Why do we have to do this? Here are my reasons. Here are why it's important to us right here, right now. So there are a mixture of things in the business case, and we've actually provided written an ebook on exactly this subject, on the subject of making your case for preservation. Because as we've already heard today, there's not a lot of existing practice out there yet. Not when you compare it to library management systems or information library systems. So you will probably firstly be in a position in having to make an argument for why this is even important, as we were saying earlier, why a backup isn't good enough, those sorts of arguments. So are you looking to protect your assets? Is it that you need to make sure that the public see more of what you've got? Or, and I'm being very general because we have lots of organisations here, or is it that you want to make your precious resources available to specialist researchers or on an international scale, or those sorts of motivations? So do you need to actually increase your profile of your organisation? And access and reputation usually go together. Is part of the motivation for making things archive for the long term, preserving things for decades to come, is that important for your own institutional reputation? Could you actually step out onto a bigger stage, metaphorically, if you as an organization were able to say, we have this really precious thing, this collection, this whatever it is, and people should know about it? Stepping on from that again, is part of that reason to actually make some money out of this thing, to actually allow people to download for a fee or come and access it in a particular way? There'll be lots of different ways, you know, order prints, you know, copies of the picture of the castle or whatever it is. And in a public library context, that can be really important. We've certainly seen that in the UK, for example. Is part of the reason why you need to do this to actually free up some time for staff? Do you need to automate these processes more easily because you can't afford the resources you have, or you know that you need to do more with this data, and you don't have the ability to add 5 extra people to your team. Wouldn't that be lovely? But that's not very likely, I don't think, unless you're going to tell me otherwise. So how do I do all these big things, these new things? Because these are all relatively new processes that we're talking about for most of you. How do I realistically do that without adding 5 members of staff to my team? Because that's not possible. And so, again, from a technology point of view, we take it as our responsibility to address some of these motivations, to be able to say, actually, we can do all these cool things, which Sinead will show you. And it needn't necessarily be very heavy on staff. So we're trying to get that balance between control and configurability and flexibility and resource management, people management. So we can do it that way. It's probably a mixture of everything. It's probably all of those things. But again, talking a little bit about the project and why, the whys and the reasons behind it, these are an important place to start internally if you're trying to get support for this idea of, look, we need to start preserving all of this stuff that we've digitized. We've spent all this money on digitizing our collection. And I can quote from a heritage organization in the UK. They have hard drives of data on the shelf behind them. And they say, look, it's preserved. There it is. Isn't that great? And yes, that is great. But only to a point, of course. It only goes so far. And having extra copies and being able to digitize something is fantastic. And it's the first step, of course it is. But it's not going to be enough. And very quickly, you may find that the investment that you've made, for example, in digitizing these collections could be lost or partially corrupted if you're not looking after that digital result of these digitization projects. And of course, as we've heard already from Miklos, the volume and the diversity of the born digital data is almost impossible to understand, humanly understand. So we understand the problem there. So if we are doing a project then, seriously, where do we start? And we can try and give you some help, some guidance, some examples of where other people have started and what we're doing here at the National Library, of course. It starts with some very simple questions, like most projects, I suppose. What is worrying me the most? What is making me not sleep very well at night? And that's a great place to start. So what sort of data types do you have? What file formats are they in? You will know this probably. Although, as Sinead said, sometimes people don't. Sometimes the biggest problem is, I have no idea what we have. Or I know what I have. I don't know what the rest of the organization has that they're supposed to give to me, but they haven't. And we find this a lot in research in academia, for example. So try to get a handle somehow on what you might have. And you will be at different levels of maturity in that journey of understanding what you have. And also remembering, of course, that digital preservation we're talking about today. But we are also talking about what you need to provision for 5 years time or 10 years time. And that's almost impossible to predict. So to have an idea of what sorts of files or what sorts of departments or locations you might have in the future, or at least providing a level of flexibility in your resources and your IT solutions to cope with the most likely situations in the future. As I mentioned earlier, that's kind of the best that we can hope for. And again, the mixture between digitized and born digital or digital native items and trying to understand exactly what the difference is for you in between your organization is going to be really important. So what does it actually involve then? Well, again, it always, at this stage in the maturity of digital data archiving and in the industry that we are in, it almost always starts with this business case, with making an argument internally within your organization to say, I need time, I need resources, I need project scope for doing something bigger and better with our digital data collection. Assuming that that goes really easily, and that could be a year in itself, and we're very used to people taking a long time to get past that point. But assuming that you have, we then start to talk about scope and planning. So very traditional, any project will obviously start there. But from a preservation point of view, as I say, we start to ask these specific questions about your collection, because that helps people like us, like Archivum and EBSCO, to actually predict and plan your ingest needs, your egress needs. Mm. How much of your collection, do you know the answer to this question? How much of your collection will you need back at any point? Nobody can answer that. So you have to predict what your usage might be like. And again, build in flexibility in case that perhaps and certainly will change. Make sure that you obviously provide a layer of project management. And for us, for Archivum, for preservation projects, that project management very heavily includes things like integration, includes things like making sure that the data is ingesting correctly from several different places. It's being spat out into several different places. And for example, here we're talking about a number of different institutions. So you've got a lot of input strands as well. So it's a complicated set of requirements, potentially. User acceptance testing, of course. We actually help people with these test scenarios because, again, people won't have a back catalogue of preservation test scenarios that they've used on the systems that they've bought before. So we will actually provide that to people and make sure that they are sort of helped through the process, whilst also adding in obviously your own requirements. And go live as well. Go live in as much as go live with phase one, usually. Because again, with many IT systems, but particularly for data archiving, it's usually a very good idea to phase the approach because you will have an iterative or an evolving need. So we're very used to being able to do that. And of course, usually project plans end at go live. Hurrah! We're done. But of course, that's obviously the start. That's actually the start of the whole thing, of course, isn't it? So we have a whole process within Archivum, certainly, to do with customer success, ongoing management. These changes that happen very specifically in data archiving that say, we have suddenly had approval for a massive digitization project. What we thought was going to happen for the next 3 years, forget it. It's all changed. So it's the ability to be able to live with those sorts of requirements as well. As you will have seen, no digital preservation event is complete without a big picture of the OAIS model, so the Open Archival Information System, as you've seen. But it is worth bearing in mind that actually this kind of left to right process of moving data through a number of workflows is really important. And actually, any system that you're looking to implement, either yourselves or with Archivum or whomever, needs to follow basically this exact path in technical terms. But what's really valuable from our point of view is that our process doesn't start on the left and finish on the right, and it doesn't have a sort of a channel view. So it's not boxed in as this tends to let you think that it would be. What we've managed to do, as Sinead will show you, is to make all this happen, I hasten to say automatically, because that's not quite right, because as I say, you would have control over what happens, but we're making this happen underneath the surface, the sort of the idea of the swan swimming on the water. This is the underwater shot, or the iceberg underneath, as Miklos was showing. And so that's the difference. That's the value with us, I think, is that we're actually providing a platform that does all of this stuff that you would imagine. It ticks all of the correct boxes, but actually we're a level above that. We're providing a management layer that gives you comfort that actually what you've got is even easier to administer than these many microservice processes will allow you to sort of get lost into if you need to. So briefly then, before we get into the good stuff, which is to actually see some of the views of the solution and how people are actually using Git, I wanted to pull out some unique differentiators, and I've tried to keep them as succinct as I ever am. So again, pulling on this point of making it easy to use, we're all different degrees of experts in this room, but we still love Google. We still order things off easy-to-use websites because they're easy to use. So there's a huge inherent human nature to make things simple, even though they're very complicated. That's how Apple has survived for so long, I'm sure. So that's the basic premise, and preservation is no different, although slightly less ubiquitous than Apple. I'm just suggesting. So we have a partner focus. Obviously, part of the reason why we're all here today is because EBSCO and Archivum are working so closely together here at the National Library, and we're really focused on that in a way that makes us unique, because we're entirely flexible with what we're doing, and equally, we are built on open standards. So we use Archivematica, we use Atom and the other artifactual released solutions. They power a lot of what we do. But as I say, what we're able to do is build this ecosystem around these open tools. So hopefully you get the best of both worlds. You get as open a system as you can possibly handle, because we know that the IT systems have to last decades and decades. But you also have the comfort of a managed service, of a support team, of the ability for us to develop it so that you don't have to hire developers to support this open source thing. That's absolutely not the case. So hopefully we're giving you the best of everything, as I say, with the fully managed service. Being able to say that we provide a 100% data integrity guarantee is really important to Archivum. And we do that by providing multiple copies and escrow copies of the data and lots of things that run in the background and keep, you know, sort of probably about half of the Archivum staff busy every day just keeping the data alive. We don't throw it in a room and lock it and throw away the key. We proactively manage the media it's stored on, the file formats that it's saved in, all of these activities that allow us to be able to say this very quick thing of 100% data integrity guarantee. Any other sort of service would give you 99.9 or something like that, which for archive material just isn't really good enough, we don't think. So that's why we provide that. Integration, I've mentioned, we're very, very, very tight on integration. And again, Sinead, from a technical perspective, can explain the hows and the whys. But again, a nice open suite of APIs means that we haven't come across yet, I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong, a system that we can't integrate with. It shouldn't be that the answer is no to any of the questions that you give us to do with the systems that you already have. Exit plan is a really interesting one. It's another unique thing to Archivum, and it's weird to be talking about an exit plan, you know, at the very beginning of any project, but we do. And actually, it's vital, because as we mentioned, you need to have the comfort that you can get to that data at any point, because it's always yours. We're just looking after it for you. So you have the ability to remove yourself from these processes as and when you need to. There's no lock-in. There's no sort of black box scenario where you have no idea what's happening with your data. So as I say, best of both worlds. And something that I really love, something that sort of gets me out of bed in the morning, the reason why I really love working at Archivum is because we understand the community. We spend a lot of time and effort making sure that we come and speak to people in our respective markets and understand, okay, so what's new? What's vexing you at this stage? GDPR was a tiny example of that. And we take a lot of time to make sure that we understand what's going on in the market, as I say, including events like this. So that's a really valuable part of what we do. Two other examples before I hand over to Sinead. We work with Tate Britain in London. And they have a, again, trying to give you some examples of, okay, well, yeah, who's doing it and what are the different deployment models or options here. So Tate have three locations on site, so very similar to what we expect to be doing here, so within the organisation itself. And they're safeguarding thousands and thousands of artworks in that way. So that's one example. And another one that I wanted to show you was the Irish Traditional Music Archive, or ITMA, based in Dublin in Ireland. That's fully hosted. So to the other end of that particular example, they don't have a lot of IT support or resources. There's not a lot of archive staff in themselves. They're quite a small organisation. They have about 17 terabytes of data that's very precious, you know, recordings of traditional music performances in Irish pubs and that sort of thing that they can't afford to lose. But they don't have a lot of time or resources or people. So they've got a fully hosted service that we manage on their behalf. So I just wanted to give you those two examples to start to make it more real about what people are actually doing and give you the ideas of where this works. So I'll hand over to Sinead to show you a demo. Did you want the slides?
Yeah.
Great stuff. Let me find those. We were trying to do a live demo, but it doesn't connect, so we've gone to plan B. You only have to worry if we get to plan Z. There we are. Okay.
All right. So, as Paula says, I'm doing the demo from some screenshots that I took off my machine earlier, just to show you. So I think one of the key things that I think I need to point out here is that we've developed the system a bit backwards to a lot of other computer systems, in that we don't see ourselves as a front-end company. You know, we're very much focused on providing that middleware layer, you know, so doing the integrations with EBSCO, with ePrints, with any of the other solutions that tend to typically and quite often be the front-end. So what we developed, as Paula and myself have both been mentioning, is a series of flexible APIs, like really, really flexible, highly scalable, being able to allow customers to permit them, it's a public open APIs that can connect and that can provide all those levels of integrations, but also provide the flexibility to organize and manage your data from whatever front end. So if you have your own front end and you want to bring that in, then you know that's completely possible. But what we were finding was that our customers were saying, you know, in some cases at the beginning of their project, you know, as Paula was saying, they can make it as complicated or as simple as possible. And what we were finding were the customers were saying, well, can you provide us with the front end that we can use for the beginning until we get our integrations done? Because if we have to talk to IT, it's going to take forever. Or, you know, so there's always that level of question. And it also, you know, it helps us to show. So what we did was we did the APIs first, and then we build the front end on top. So obviously, you know, most of our technical team is all very API and back end focused. But, you know, at least, you know, the user interface that we put on top of it really allows us to show what we're doing. So this is just sign-in page. Nothing really interesting about the sign-in page, except that you don't need to have it because we also have single sign-on. So we can integrate with most of the standard single sign-on systems. So you can actually bring it straight in from your already existing single sign-on processes. This would be the landing page. So this is where an administrator or somebody who's looking at this on a day-to-day basis will look and see the overall status. And the idea behind this screen is that they look at, I don't know if you can see better on the, yeah, you can see some actually, the colors need to be a bit clearer. So you can see the different areas and the different processes and the different flows of the data through the system. You know, and as we were saying earlier, these flows and these stages are configurable. You know, you can bring in as many or as little as you want. You can see on my system here, I've got a staging area, and then I've got data in a muted state and ready to process. The staging area would typically be if somebody's dragging and dropping the data into the system. So we provide things like WebDAV and SFTP access to be able to drag data manually into the system if you haven't connected and done an integration with your APIs, or maybe you have additional bits of data that you want to bring in that aren't, you know, that are maybe you've got a collection or something that you want to add into the system. Then, you know, so in that case, if you're dragging and dropping, there would typically be a staging area, and there'd be a point of time where you're gathering and collating that data before you want to process it. So you can see then as the data flows through, you've got the immuted, so it's all ready to go, it's ready to process. Some of it's in preservation, so you'd see how much data is currently in preservation. And then you've got the replicating phases, you know, that's the main stage of, you know, where you're taking your data and you're transferring it after you've done all of your processing and preservation. And then you've got the writing to tape, if you're using tapes. And then you've got the coming back from escrow as escrow verified. So that is, so in this example, you've got tapes that are being written on top of having your data replicated across to multiple geographical location. And then those tapes are going to an escrow provider who are keeping them in storage. And that's, as Paula mentioned, you know, the exit criteria. So you've got your exit clause. You can always go back and get your data at any time you want. It's your data. It's always there. It's always available. And it's in a standard format. The escrow, though, of course, doesn't have to be tape. In this day and age, you know, some of our customers are using online providers. You know, you can have your data going from, you know, from an Amazon to a Glacier. You can have it, you know, in Google, Azure. You can have a combination of different online providers. And we also, you know, as we were saying earlier, we also have customers who have an on-premise solution. So it's completely flexible how you can deploy the system, completely flexible where it goes. The only requirements that we have is that it has to be in those separate geographical locations to enable us to provide that really important 100% data integrity guarantee. So we have to make sure that it's separate. The idea of this landing page is that the administrator will be looking at it and looking to identify if there are any issues, and they could see an alert. So you can see that there's alerts there if there's anything inconsistent with the data. But you can also see when the last processing was carried out in your system. So you can see that when the preservation completed, when the replication was done. So you can see if there were any bottlenecks or any challenges, and you would be alerted to them as well. But at least you've got an overview and you can see all the data in the system. And as it grows, you can see the volumes rising. If this was live, you'd be able to also see, as I hover over it, it'll show you more information on the stats of that data. Then as you go into the data, now I borrowed some information from Neil Young last year, I think it was, published all of his music. And so he put a Neil Young Archives, which is a great website, brilliant quality of music if anybody likes Neil Young. But I took like some inspiration from that to try and demonstrate some of the record management and the PCDM use cases and the functionality. So I took some of the information that he had, some of the typical metadata that you might have attached to music recordings and to video recordings, and I added them in. So the files that are in the system are all linked, you know, are all like different songs, different albums, and then different collections of data from him. So this is a file search. So in the search, we've got, as we were saying earlier, we put in Elasticsearch functionality, highly scalable. On the search screen, in the real system, you could actually go in and you can search on any of the metadata titles. So you can just click on the title. You can enter your different search criteria. It could be greater than, less than, like, contains, equal, date ranges, et cetera, depending on what your metadata is. And it will come up with a context-specific search. And then you can filter your data down. You can decide then to add it into records. You can decide to export it. You can request downloads from it as well from this screen. So for the individual file level, so you can see the different. Oh, I just flipped forward twice. So you can see the different options here that are. I can add it to a record. I can add it to an existing record. I can download it, or I can also download the list to a PDF. So it's a print option. Then going up to the next level. So the next level that we talked about in PCDM was the objects. In this screen, it's called record management, and you can see the different collections starting to come together. You know, so you've got your objects. Those objects might be an album, and that album would have several songs in it. Or it could be a single that you've got the long-term storage format as well as the different versions. So you might have WAV, you might have MP3, you might have all the different types of audio formats that you would have. And you can start grouping and collating the data together in this level. And then you can start managing it. So you can see on the management screen. So you see my options here about retention policies. The retention policies, I think, are probably less relevant in your industries, but can be useful as well, because you can use them for things like if you have to make data public in 25 years, you could set a retention policy on it that says notify the users that this is about to be made public. Or, you know, or if you did have stuff that you want to get rid of or you want to assess in a certain number of years, you can add retentions. And you can also apply holds, which means that you can't delete anything. So if you've got a hold on any object or any collection, it means that none of the retention policies for deletion would apply, or any PCDM requests, or not PCDM, sorry, GDPR, get my acronyms mixed up now. I know, I said the two of them so many times. It's good. So if you put a hold on something, it means that nothing can be removed. You can't touch it. And that's very relevant in, of course, in regulated industries where they want to be able to put legal holds on stuff and they've got evidence building and stuff. But within the edit of the record management, then, I don't know how well you can see it on your screen. You can see here I've got some different records, and those records are songs in this list. And you can actually add and remove. So I can start managing manually what I can also do automatically in my ingest or in my update processes. So everything that I can do on the APIs, I can now see here, and I can go in and I would be able to add different entries, remove entries. If I get new file formats, if I get additional information, I can start going in and I can start building up more and more data. So it's obviously really helpful if you don't know what you don't know whenever you get the data at the beginning, that you can then do the subsequent management of it and organization of the content. And then the next level up is the record set. So this is related to, this is PCDM collections. Again, you know, so collections can contain other, oops, that's, oh, I didn't screenshot the, so the collections can contain other collections or they can contain objects. And so you can build up, so it's a similar screen to here, but you've got that level up. So you've got the level up that says record set and records, and you can add and remove stuff there as well. So you start building up more and more details, and you can see here in my collections, I had several different layers of it. So I had a Neil Young Global, I had Neil Young singles, videos, albums, then I had early years, and I had and then I had different collaborations that he did. So you can start to see how things can actually be cross-referenced and be grouped together at different layers. So the idea would be that the Neil Young Global one would contain all of these collections underneath it. And underneath those collections, you might have different singles, you have different years, you have, you know, and they can be part of them. But the underlying files are the same, but you can contextualize your content a lot better in the system. And obviously, even if this is something that's available now, it means that if somebody is coming down the line 20 years' time, 30 years' time, if they're trying to find stuff, you know, this will help them. You know, this will actually provide them a lot more information and context to be able to find stuff. And then, of course, in addition to everything, as with, you know, with most software systems, you know, an audit trail is hugely important, especially as we're allowing things like secure exports or downloads or any of that information. You want to make sure that everything's audited. So all of this, all of the data coming into the system all gets added to the audit trail. All of the data that's accessed, user access, all of that good stuff all gets put through the audit trail. And then you've got some other reports in there as well, in and around the usage of the system. So for example, if you had several internal customers, and you had customers who had different parts of the archive and have access to different parts, you can view and you can see what their usage is of the system. So you can see if they need more space or if they need more budget or, you know, any of the things. So it's all about the monitoring and the management of the system, being able to control it, being able to see what's going on, and of course, you know, bringing that data to life, making it accessible. So, you know, so knowing that, you'll be able to go back and retrieve that data at any point in the future. So that's the demo part done. I'm doing the roadmap now. Okay. It's my fun part. Okay. Do I have to? Is that it? Okay. So, you know, so as we were saying, every single thing that we're doing, every single thing that I'm doing is living and breathing, bringing the data to life, bringing the archive data to life. And the stuff that we focused on throughout last year was around bringing in those record management products, you know, bringing in those capability, the functionality, focusing on extending our integrations, our out-of-the-box integrations with common common tools, common systems, stabilization. And, of course, before that, it was all about the safeguarding, the preservation, the data integrity. So as we've been going along, and you can see the different product modules, but we've been building on top of everything that we have and everything that we do. In the release that we have just released, so the one that I've just showed you the screenshots of, that was the search capability. So adding that advanced extended search capability, the metadata, you know, that I mentioned earlier about the metadata extraction, and also the metadata processing of any type of metadata that you want. And then we had the visualization, which was the dashboard that we've added on top of our existing functionality. The other things that we've covered, as I was saying earlier, we had a new platform. We've gone multi-tenancy, so it means that we can keep the cost of ownership down. And, you know, it means that we can manage multiple systems and keep those hardware costs down, essentially, but still making sure that we can keep the safety and the integrity of what needs to be shared, what doesn't need to be shared, and making sure that different customer systems are all kept completely separate. The secure share alludes to what Mikla was talking about earlier, about, you know, and everything I hear and everything that anybody talks about is about, you don't want to share everything. Nobody wants to share everything. You want to make sure that what you want to share is available. What you don't want to share is locked down or is given the right user access, so that granularity. So in the release that is coming next, we go into a much more level of granularity around data access, around sharing. And that sharing could go down to individual fields, even at that level. You know, if you've got, we've already brought in the functionality to be able to tag stuff as personal or as sensitive information. And that enables us to be able to track and to be able to use those for things like GDPR requests. But it also enables us to provide this functionality in a secure sharing perspective. And that's, you know, maybe you don't want to share email addresses, but you want to share some of the other metadata and you want to share some of the results or the collations of information. So that's what that secure sharing is about. And then ingest validation is about adding more and more levels of the validations of data coming in, what needs to be done with it. And that ties in as well to automation and more automating of the processes. You know, as Paula was talking about earlier, about as part of your project life cycle, at the beginning in the workshops, you'll be talking about the egress rates and how much of your data you want to get back, when you want to get it back. A lot of the time people don't know that, and it's best guess. What we're looking to do as we move into 2019 is be able to automate that process. So actually be able to apply some analytics on top of the data, apply some artificial intelligence, and be able to say, actually, this data is not being accessed. This data is not needed. Let's move that out to cold storage and let's keep some of this stuff in a more accessible format, because at this point, you know, this information is still being used. So we're looking at more and more levels. You know, at the minute, it's all done manually. Everything's moved across. If you're looking at different storage locations, we would move it to different locations manually. But what we're looking at is actually providing the flexibility to automate that and to actually calculate and say and make predictions around what people are going to need. And that's all, again, with a view of that total cost of ownership, you know, bringing the cost down in that saying that you don't need. And I know that, you know, a lot of our customers have a lot of internal customers who are looking at, you know, who are looking at the storage options. And of course, if you ask anybody internally, their automatic reaction is going to be, I need it all. I need it available all the time. I just need it to be there. I need it. I don't know what I'm going to need. I don't know when I'm going to need it, but I need it to be able to access it really quickly. Whereas most of the time they don't. And we've seen some of our customers actually start asking for this calculator option, you know, where you can actually show them the cost and they can pass on those costs internally. And then so we're going to go with that level of tiered storage. And then we want to actually move forward into automating that, you know, so actually making the recommendations and saying that as and when you need the data and managing it in that way. Again, there's more and more reporting options that we're adding. It's all about, for me anyway, it's all about the data. It's all about the data and the value that data can bring. There's masses and masses of data, and it's about understanding what that data is. It's about collating it. It's about preserving it, protecting it. Sorry. And about providing those integrity guarantees, but then also looking at ways that we can derive value from it. So there's so much stuff coming up in the roadmap that is really exciting. Now we have a really cool framework to build on, you know, we can add, and as I was saying, you know, a lot of it is in around the PCDM structure, you know, using that to build on and to build on that organization and the content. And then, you know, even things like Mikla was talking earlier about the levels of quality of data and people being able to submit data at different levels. From our perspective, we would say just chuck it in. Just chuck it in anyway and we'll start organizing it. We'll start getting it under control. We'll start managing it and governing it. And then you can build on it. You know, you can add those additional levels of data and you can start getting more context around it. Because for the future, context is really key for retrieving that stuff, for getting it back, for being able to access it and see it again. So I think the only other thing then to look at is our release beats. So we have three releases typically in a year. So our first release, our 4.3 release, was actually in January this year. Now we've got version 5 has just been released. So I'm quite excited about that. It's all quite hot off the press, what you've just seen. And then we've got 5.1 coming in at the end of September, start of October. And then we'll build on that again with 5.2 come January again. So I like to make sure that I keep the engineering team busy. We keep them on their toes with, you know, with all the requests. And, you know, and one of the things that I really like and one of the things I'm looking forward to is having conversation with people, you know, talking about what their challenges are, what their problems are. So we always like to make sure that our customers and our partners can feed back into us and tell us, you know, what their challenges are, what their issues are. We have a product advisory council sessions that Paul and I are kicking off in London, where we have some of the universities from around there, and we like to gather them together at a round table session to make sure that, you know, that we're sitting. And then it's, you know, from my perspective as a product manager, it's a fantastic way for me to hear insight and me to get some input into what problems they're facing, what challenges they have, and then being able to actually find ways to address those challenges, you know, find ways to, and you know, as Paula was saying as well, you know, we've got customers from such diverse businesses and such diverse needs. We've got customers like the ITMA who want a complete managed service, and who really want to, you know, to make sure that we take everything and we do it all for them. And then we've got other customers who like to do a lot of it themselves and who like to get into the nuts and bolts. And you know, both provide a really valid feedback and really valid inputs to us. And I like getting them together as well to have conversations with them about, you know, because sometimes they learn from each other's business practices as well. So we're very, you know, we're very keen on collaboration, on bringing in inputs and getting inputs from our customers, from our partners, from, you know, from industry specialists. And so, you know, so there's a lot of stuff. I've learned a lot over the last 18 months, I have to say, about archiving and about data, long-term data management. Still a lot to learn, I'm sure, but I think I've got the right people in place to give me the information, including you guys. Okay. That's the robot done, I think. Who's going?
So we're just 15 minutes early for breakfast.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah.